Robert Murray McChain, a man of great passion, wrote these words in his diary shortly after his conversion. Listen carefully to these words. June the 30th, 1832. Much careless sin and sorrow. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? Enter my soul into the rock, and hide you in the dust for fear of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. In the same year, a month later, he wrote, in July 22nd, had this evening a more complete understanding of that self-emptying and abasement with which it is necessary to come to Christ. A denying of self, trampling it underfoot, a recognizing of the complete righteousness and justice of God that could do nothing else with us but condemn us utterly and thrust us down to the lowest hell. A feeling that even in hell we should rejoice in his sovereignty and say that all was rightly done. End of quote. This man had a profound sense of his own sin. And he had that profound sense of his own sin, and he had it in the light of a high view of God's holiness. What is even more remarkable about what was written here is this man was only 19 years of age when he penned those entries in his diary. He became the minister of St. Peter's Church in Dundee, Scotland, ministering only 7.5 years, and died at the age of 29. By the way, that's the age I thought I would die. Interesting, isn't it? Yet the fruitfulness of his brief life remains with us even to this day. Why? Because he had a genuine, life-changing encounter with a holy, transcendent God. A God who stripped him of his self-focus and captivated his heart to a purpose far greater than his own minuscule thoughts and his own grandeur. A focus that lifted his life back to its original created purpose in God, a life that was to be lived for the glory of God. This week, a 31-year-old, happily married man named Christian, who had only a short time to live because of being diagnosed with a brain tumor, posted a video on YouTube. And he was asking pastors and leaders the question, imagine if I came to your church this Sunday. What would I see? What would I hear? Would I hear that God loves me and has a wonderful plan for my life? And the video clip zoomed out and zoomed in on a couple of well-known preachers who preach exactly like that. And then he said, is having a brain tumor a wonderful plan? Just really a wonderful plan for my life? The rest of the video cut in and out of portions of church services being offered out there in the marketplace, churches with a focus on healing, on sex, on power, and on image. We live in a time where self-image and self-esteem and self-indulgence and self-centeredness is as much at home in the church as it is at home in the world. How did that come about? How did this happen to God's church? Well, I believe it came about because we fashioned a God who suits us. A God, yes, that we worship. A God for sure that we bow down to, but it's not the God of the Bible. It's a God that we have packaged to fit our unholy lifestyles. God who will always forgive. A God who will wink at your sin. A God who's not troubled at all when you walk in unrighteousness or profane his name. A God who is always eagerly waiting to hear our praises, even if they come from an impure heart. That's the kind of God we've fashioned in the church today. A God who's about being positive and not negative. A God who's all about you. But is that the God of the Bible? Is that this holy, transcendent God that we are called to worship? What about those who existed in the hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, who the writer of Hebrews says experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went out in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. Men, it says, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground, and all these, it says, having gained approval for their faith. What about those people? How was it that these people could endure such horrific lives, such horrific things happening to them? Well, I believe the answer is that they came to know this holy God. All of these people came to know a transcendent, pure God who was worthy to love even unto death because he first loved them unto death. It is a knowledge of the God who transcends this world that enables us to live purposefully even when persecuted, to live victoriously over the flesh because we exist not for temporal purposes but for eternal purposes. Our God, let me remind you, is holy, holy, holy. What does that mean to you? And how does your knowledge of His holiness affect what you do during the week and how you live your life? As I've said over and over again in this series on the study of the holiness of God, this is not some distant theoretical, theological concept that has no application to life. No, this study on the holiness of God is directly related to everyday living because the Scripture calls you and I to be holy as God is holy. And so therefore a grasp of the holiness of God should change our attitudes and our actions and our conduct in life. And because as Christians we are called to live lives that are filled with worship of God, therefore, a knowledge of the holiness of God is crucial to worship God in a manner that's pleasing to Him. In the Old Testament, worship was closely regulated, and in the New Testament, more freedom seems to be given in worship. The priesthood of a few in the Old Testament has become the priesthood of all believers in the New Testament. But Acts chapter 5 and 1 Corinthians 11 and 1 Corinthians 5 strongly warn us about worship that fails to take the holiness of God seriously. Irreverence is a most serious offense, as we can see from both the Old and New Testaments. Worship is one area where irreverence is a common and constant concern. Some in their zeal to worship God have ended up profaning His holy name because they don't take what God considers acceptable and unacceptable worship seriously. A well-known portion of Scripture reminds us that to obey God is better than sacrifice, and to hearken or to heed better than the fat of rams, 1 Samuel 15:22. But perhaps one of the most striking passages on how God's holiness should impact what we do and don't do is found in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 to 11, in the account of the death of Uzzah. Now let me give you some background to this passage before we read through some of these portions. So walk with me. What we're going to do tonight is we're going to take a journey through the history of Israel leading up to the time of this man Uzzah. And then we're going to learn, hopefully, draw some key lessons from the narrative section of this man's life. I want to take you on a journey to a turbulent time in the life of Israel, where a new king, King David, had been appointed over in place of King Saul, and victories against Israel's enemies were abounding. David was a man of war. He was a man of righteousness. He was a man who loved God, and he wanted the righteousness and the glory of God to be known not only in Israel, but in the regions about him. Israel's enemies were abounding, and yet, even in the victories, as we're going to see tonight, there were failures. There were failures. And I trust that some of these failures we can draw lessons from tonight and apply to this area of worshiping a holy God, living lives of worship to a holy God. When the Israelites were being beaten by the Philistines, they unwisely took the Ark of God into the battle with them as a kind of magic charm. This was based on the counsel of Hophni and Phinehas. You may remember that Phinehas and Hophni were the sons of Eli. Eli was the priest in Israel, who, according to 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 12, if you want to come and just walk through some of these passages as we go through here, in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 12, we find that according to the record here, that these men were worthless. It says, "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord and the custom of the priests with the people." Worthless men. Imagine that on your tombstone. "Here lie two worthless men who did not know the Lord." Eli, who was the priest of Israel, knew that his sons were not only worthless, but they were absolutely living sexually promiscuous lifestyles. They were having sexual relations with a woman who served in the temple alongside them. Come over to verse 22 of the same chapter, 1 Samuel 2 and 22. It says, "Now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all of Israel, and how they lay with women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, 'Why do you do such evil things that I hear from all these people? Know, my sons, for the report is not good which I hear the Lord's people circulating.'" And yet, as wrong as Eli knew the behavior of his sons were, there's a frightening phrase, and it says this. In 1 Samuel 2, pick it up in verse 27. "Then a man of God came to Eli, and he said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, did I not indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when you were in Egypt in bondage in Pharaoh's house? Did I not choose them from all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar and to burn incense, to carry an ephod before me? And did I not give to the house of your father all the fire offerings of the sons of Israel? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering which I have commanded in my dwelling? And why do you honor your sons above me?'" That's the frightening phrase right there. "Why do you honor your sons above me by making yourself fat with the choicest of every offering of my people Israel?" It's kind of an answer in that question. The answer that, and I believe the reason that Eli honored his sons above the Lord, was because his sons were providing Eli with a lifestyle of ease and comfort. But the issue isn't the why. The issue is that he was doing this, that he was honoring his sons above the Lord in this particular realm of priestly service unto the Lord. And so God told Eli that he would raise up another priest who would take his place. We know that priest, as we read on in the book of Samuel, to be none other than the namesake of the book, Samuel himself. God was going to raise up Samuel, and Samuel was that man, and God revealed to Samuel that Eli and his house would be judged. Come over to chapter 3, 1 Samuel 3, and look at verse 10 here. "Then the Lord came and stood and called as at the other time, 'Samuel.' Samuel. And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." The Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. And that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from the beginning to the end. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew because his sons brought a curse on themselves and he did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice and offering forever." Young man Samuel receives these words of the old priest concerning the old priest and his family. And he has to carry that message as a young man, being raised up as a prophet and a priest. And he has to carry that message to this older man. I wonder if you were in that situation, how faithful you would be. God revealed some things to you. And the older man was to ask you, "What did the Lord say?" What would you say? Well, Samuel was honest. And he told him. He spoke the word of the Lord, and Eli's response was, "May the Lord do as he wills." Now, at this time, the Philistines came out against Israel in battle and defeated Israel, and the Philistines killed nearly 4,000 men of the nation of Israel on the battlefield. This is over in chapter 4, verse 10. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was very great, for there fell on Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. This is a little later on, after the 4,000. 30,000 foot soldiers, and the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So there's a battle going on between Israel and the Philistines. Israel thought, you know what, we'll go out there, we'll rout these Philistines. David had already been in that situation as a young man and seen the mighty name of God and the power of God as he wandered down there into that little brook and picked up five stones and took one, put in his sling, and took out a 9-foot giant. And with that one act, the nation of Israel went and took control of this nation of the Philistines. But they regrouped, and they grew again, became strong, and they were a threat. And so they went out to fight. And as we read here, as they went out to fight, they decided that what they needed to do was to take the Ark of God with them, because they'd already had 4,000 men die, and this was, whoa, what's going on here? And so they went and got the Ark of God. They brought it out into the battle. And the Ark was captured. It was taken by the Philistines. 30,000 men, foot soldiers, were killed that day. And Eli sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. And the moment Eli heard the news that his sons had died, that the Ark of the Covenant, had been captured in the battle, he knew that that was the end of his sons. And he fell backwards, broke his neck, and died. The Philistines had captured the Ark of God, and they decided to keep this Ark as a trophy of their victory. The ark that we're speaking of is the Ark of the Covenant. It was the ark that was fashioned and made and built with gopher wood, and it was covered in gold, and it had this lid put on the top of it with the mercy seat, and I mentioned this morning the two cherubim beaten out of pure gold, and the presence of God dwelt above the mercy seat between the two cherubim coming up on each side with the wings overshadowing the glory of God. This is the ark that they decided they needed to take in the battle in order to have God's presence with them. And they lost it. The Philistines captured it as a trophy, but the ark soon became a source of much suffering for the Philistines. They moved it about, and wherever they placed it, there were problems. People were dying, things were happening, there were diseases, tumors, all kinds of disastrous things were happening. And so finally they decided, we've had enough of this thing from Israel, this ark, this box. It's caused too much trouble. Let's get rid of it. Let's send it back to Israel. And so they got a cart, and they put a guilt offering of gold inside the ark, and they placed it on a newly made cart, and they put two cows in the front of the ark, and they sent it on their way. In the chapters 5 and 6, we have the record of that whole process happening. Look at chapter 6 with me, verse 7. Let's read this account here, verses 7 through 12. "Now therefore take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there has never been a yoke, and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them." Now, if you know anything about farming, some of you do, if you take the calves of cows away and you put them in the farthest field on your farm or your ranch, and then you set the cows free, where are you going to find them in the morning with the calves, right? That's where they're going to be. So this was kind of interesting. They took the cows away, and they put on these cows this cart on which a yoke had never been placed on them. They hitched the cows to the calves, and they sent them on their ways. It says in verse 8, "Take the ark of the Lord, place it on the cart, and put the articles of gold, which you return to him as a guilt offering, in a box by its side. And then send it away that it may go. Watch if it goes up by the way of its own territory to Beth Shemesh. Then he has done us this great evil." In other words, if the cows leave their calves behind and head back towards Israel and go up to what was right on the border of Judah, a town called Beth Shemesh, if the cows head to that town, then the Philistines would be able to say, this great evil that we have gone through, this great trial and difficulty, is truly the result of the God of Israel. And so they sent it away. Verse 10, "Then the men did so, and they took two milk cows and hitched them to the cart. They shut up the calves at home, and they put the ark of the Lord on the cart, and the box with the golden mice, and the likeness of their tumors." These were some of the things that they had endured. "And the cows took the straight way in the direction of Beth Shemesh, and went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines followed them to the border of Beth Shemesh." Now, if the Philistines couldn't stand the presence of a holy God, as represented by the Ark of the Covenant, neither could the people of Beth Shemesh. Look at verse 19 of 1 Samuel 6. This is what happened as the cart arrived in Beth Shemesh. He, God, struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down all the people, 50,070 men. And the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. The men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God?" Just understand, put yourself in the shoes of these men of Beth Shemesh. You see this horse, these two cows, and this cart rumbling down the road towards you. There's no one on board. They're just coming on down the road. And as you look out, as the cart gets closer, you begin to see the shape, this unusual shape, the shape that even in the nations of the world today, people know the shape of the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat with the two cherubim. And you look and you begin to wonder, what is going on? And as the cart gets closer, your interest is piqued. And you begin to think, could this possibly be the Ark of God or the Ark of the Covenant? And so you wander on over. and out of a good desire to prove that what is in front of you is the ark of God in which the presence of God dwells, you open the lid and you look inside. And the glory of the Lord came out and struck him down. Now, there's some argument over whether the phrase 50,000 is the right number. I accept it because it's there. And if you go back and look, there's no real settled position. It's just 50,070 men struck down. And I think the issue here is that the number is so great because the sin was so great. And you're going to see that as we go on here. Next step in the story of the Ark of God is when we find King David in 2 Samuel carefully consulting the leaders of the nation regarding the return of the Ark of God to Jerusalem. The entire nation decides that this is the right time. When David is having all his victories and the Philistines are being routed, this is the right time now to bring the Ark of the Covenant back up from it wasn't in Beth Shemesh, it was laid aside for a while in the house of, and I can't even remember his name, it's just run away from me. But David saw this is the time to bring the Ark up to Jerusalem. And so, in 1 Chronicles, we get that account. And I want you to just jump over to 1 Chronicles. This is kind of the briefest account I think we have. And then we're going to bounce back into 2 Samuel. 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verses 1 through 5. Then David consulted with the captains of the thousands and the hundreds, even with every leader. Important statement. He gets all the leaders together. And he consults with them. And he says to all the assembly of Israel, if it seems good to you, and if it is from the Lord our God, let us send everywhere to our kinsmen who remain in all the land of Israel, also to the priests and Levites who are with them in their cities with pasture lands, that they may meet with us. And let us bring back the ark of our God to us. For we did not seek it in the days of Saul. Perhaps tells you a little bit about King Saul. And then all the assembly said that they would do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. And so David assembled all Israel together from Shihor of Egypt, even to the entrance of Hamath, to bring the Ark of God from Kiriath-Jearim. That's where the Ark was. Kiriath-Jearim. David was accompanied by 30,000 Israelites. He went to Kiriath-Jearim to bring back the ark to Jerusalem. The ark, as I've already stated, was where the presence of God was positioned. It was a symbol of the presence of God. It was a most holy object found in the holy of holies in the tabernacle. It was hidden in that place. Only the high priest could look upon that ark one time a year. That's how holy it was to the nation of Israel. But these people, David's people, David himself, had forgotten how holy the ark was. So come back to 2 Samuel and let's see what actually happened when they go and get this ark of God and start to bring it back. 2 Samuel chapter 6. In verse 1 we read, "Now the ark of the Lord..." Get the right chapter here in my Bible. 2 Samuel chapter 6. "Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal-le-Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. They placed the ark of God on a new cart, that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. And so they brought it up with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Ahio was walking ahead of the ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood, with lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. They were having a great old celebration here. But when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. The anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence, and he died there by the ark of God. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And so David was afraid of the Lord that day. And he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Thus the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. Now, it's hard to understand a story like this. It's hard to understand the whole history of this movement of the ark and the slaying of so many people. It's hard to understand how a young man like Uzzah here, who out of the desire to protect what was God's, out of a desire to reach out and stop the ark falling off the cart onto the ground, finds himself struck down and is killed by the Lord. It's hard to understand that. But in Numbers chapter 4, verse 15, we find exactly what was going on. Let me come back there with you. Numbers 4, verse 15, and then verses 17 through 20. Listen carefully. Uzzah was a Kohathite. And as a Kohathite, he was under strict instructions of the Lord in the way he was to handle that Ark of the Covenant. In Numbers 4:15, it says, "When Aaron and his sons had finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp was to set out," and speaking of the time as Israel was to move and move on, follow the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, and the cloud moved the nation of Israel to pack up everything and move with it and follow it. But in the process, Aaron and his sons, who were the priests serving in the tabernacle, when they had finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is to set out, after that, the sons of Kohath, the Kohathites, shall come and carry those objects. Carry them. So that, look at this, they will not touch the holy objects and die. I mean, you have a job as a family. You have a job in God's purpose and plan for the nation. He calls you out as a family. He calls the sons of Kohath out and he says, "You are to be the ones that carry the holy objects in the tabernacle. When I move, the sons of Aaron are going to cover up all those holy objects and you're going to come and you're going to carry them, but you must not touch them, because if you touch them, you'll die." It's not that difficult. It's not that hard. Seems a pretty clear instruction, doesn't it? Don't touch the holy object. If you touch it, you're dead. Verse 17. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, 'Do not let the tribe or the families of the Kohathites be cut off from among the Levites, but do this to them, that they may live and not die when they approach the holy objects. Aaron and his sons shall go in and assign each of them to his work and to his load. But they," that's the Kohathites, "shall not go in to see the holy objects, even for a moment, or they will die." Ouch. Now we've just increased the stakes. You can't touch a holy object or you're dead. If you're the sons of Kohath and you're about to move these holy objects that are in the tabernacle. But now, we read, and verse 9:20 here, that not only could they not touch them, but if they even looked upon them for a moment, they would die. That helps us to understand a little bit more about the story of Uzzah. Kohathites, therefore, were forbidden to look upon the Ark of the Covenant. Kohathites were not even to touch the sacred vessels of the temple when they transported them. Kohathites were to carry the Ark of God on wooden poles inserted through gold rings. And if you go back into Exodus 25, you'll find how the Ark of the Covenant was manufactured. And on each side of the Ark of the Covenant were four rings fastened, two on each side. And there were poles made of acacia wood that were overlaid with gold that they were to slide through the rings, and they were to carry the Ark of the Covenant on those poles. The instructions are extremely clear. All that to say this: if you read the story of Uzzah in 2 Samuel chapter 6, and you think to yourself, well, that doesn't seem very fair. All he was doing was trying to protect the ark from hitting the ground. If you read it and think like that, you're not thinking rightly. You see, Uzzah was not an innocent man. Uzzah was guilty. He wasn't an innocent man making a small mistake. He was guilty, guilty, guilty. And yet once again, even though these men were given a national job to oversee the moving of the tabernacle sacred objects, even though they had that job, and even though here in 2 Samuel chapter 6, they're doing it entirely wrong, God is still gracious. God is still gracious. And they placed that ark on that cart, and God's anger rightfully could have gone out and destroyed the whole lot of them. Why? Because they were not treating him as holy. See, what's the issue here? The issue is this. As the cart toppled, maybe it went into a pothole, maybe it was going down on a bit of an angle into this vineyard table or ground area, and maybe it was on a bit of an angle and it bumped on something and the cart began to topple. The ark began to slide and topple towards the edge of the cart. The issue is this. The issue is that Uzzah believed that he was more holy than the ground on which the ark, had it not been held, had God allowed it to slide off and hit the ground. He believed his hand was more holy, more pure, more undefiled than the ground, more undefiled than the ground, the dirt in which it would have fallen. The reality is this: dirt's not sinful at all. Dirt's not unholy. I know your mother said cleanliness is next to godliness. Dirt's not sinful, but the human heart is. The human heart is sinful because it's rebellious. The human heart is sinful because it does not treat God as holy. The human heart is sinful because it breaks God's holy law over and over and over and over and over again. And with Uzzah, as he was walking alongside that cart and he saw that ark getting to topple, in his mind he's thinking, I need to step in here and stop it from hitting the dirty ground. That's one view. That's one lesson I think we can learn. Uzzah had a high view of himself. He had a wrong view of himself. He thought that he was holy enough to help God out. Guess what? None of us are holy enough to help God out. And if you think that you've cleaned up your cup enough for God to use you, you haven't understood what the salvation God offers is all about. And it's not about you cleaning up the cup. It's about Him cleaning your cup. It's about Him making you holy. It's about Him sanctifying your life. Mankind's sinfulness and evil is such that the whole world groans. The whole world system, the cosmos, is under the judgment and the condemnation of God. And it groans longing for the day of its redemption. Romans 8, 19 to 22 tells us that. And I think we fall into the same trap, where we think that God needs our help. God doesn't need our help. God could have floated the ark off the cart and delivered it through the air if He had wanted to. Nothing impossible for God. But when men take that which is holy and they treat it as though it's common, with their own common hand, then look out. God is a holy God, a wrathful, holy, holy, holy God. What are some conclusions, some lessons we can learn from this? Firstly, I believe we learn as we've read the whole account here, we see that all of the incidences that were happening around the Ark of the Covenant were a means for God to preserve a sense of His holiness amongst the nation of Israel, and even amongst the foreign nations. If we had time to read that whole account, you'd learn a little bit about how the Philistines were fearful when they brought the Ark of the Covenant up initially to do battle. And there was a great shout from the nation of Israel when the Philistines heard that the Ark of the Covenant had arrived. They were scared silly, because they knew the power of God. And so God literally strikes this man dead, literally strikes 50,070 men dead, literally brings pain and suffering and tumors and difficulties to Philistines, all for the purpose of preserving in this world a sense of God's holiness and a fear of drawing near to Him. You say, Andy, every time you preach on this, I feel like you're driving people away. I'm just telling you what the Scripture says. God is to be feared. And the people who come to God with an irreverent heart, the people who come to God without a brokenness and a contrition over their sin, are the people who don't fear God as they should fear God. And the church today is filled with people. It's literally filled with people who don't fear God. They just come, they do their thing, they go their way, they live their life, and it's nice to have a little God that they can tuck into their pocket and call on when they need help. David and those involved in transporting the ark erred on several different ways. One, they'd lost a sense of awe and reverence. David forgot to inquire of the Lord. David later on gets on his face and his knees and he searches out the Scriptures and he finds out exactly how God wanted them to carry the ark, and ultimately he brings it up and there's no problems because he did it the right way. They'd lost a sense of awe and reverence that one should have for the holiness of God. Secondly, they had forgotten the clear instructions of God set down in the law for transporting the ark. And thirdly, they had forgotten the hard lesson from a not too distant past. When the ark was released and it came to Beth Shemesh, they should have remembered, don't look inside the ark. Beloved, the fear of the Lord is the result of understanding His holiness. If you don't understand God's holiness, you won't fear God. If you don't fear God, then what are you being saved from? Because the Christian message is bound up in that one essence. It's bound up in the essence that we are saved from a wrathful, holy God. We are saved from Him, and we are saved to Him, and we are saved by Him. And the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. And when you understand that, then all of a sudden, the beauty and the glory and the wonder of the cross begins to glow and to shine into the dark recesses of your mind, and you begin to realize that what God was doing at the cross was He was satisfying this holy wrath, which is not an anger that outbursts like our anger outbursts, but it is a holy wrath that is connected directly to His nature, a nature He cannot change. He is holy, holy, holy in very nature. He can't change that. But what He can do is just like He covered that Ark of the Covenant in that tabernacle through the sons of Aaron, just like He gave different jobs, just like He provided the poles, just like He provided a way of moving that Ark of the Covenant and the sacred objects in the tabernacle without being destroyed, so too He can cover our sin. And He can provide a way for us to draw near to God. And ultimately, as we look at the tabernacle, we see the altar of sacrifice as the primary object that brought men and women close to God as they came and offered up their lambs. And we know that picture was a foreshadow, was it not, of Christ coming and laying His life down as a ransom for many. But please listen, God did not cease to be holy. God's holiness burned against His Son and judged Him for every sin you and I have ever committed so that you and I could go free. And the holiness of God on the day at the cross was satisfied, truly and genuinely satisfied for those who would come and submit their lives to Jesus Christ and have their lives covered with the blood of His Son. That's the picture. That's the essence of the salvation that we offer. What sense does the cross make if there is no holiness? And yet even with all of that, God remains holy, and as believers, we are called to be holy. Listen to these words as I close. 1 Peter 1, verse 14 says, "As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts, which were yours in your ignorance. But like the Holy One who called you, be holy. Be holy yourselves also in all your behavior. Because it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.' And if you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each man's work, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay upon earth." He's speaking to Christians here. He's not speaking to those who are outside of Christ. He's speaking to Christians. Conduct yourself with fear during your time, the time of your stay upon earth, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver and gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers, but with the precious blood as of a lamb, unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. We serve a holy God. He wants to be treated as holy. He is jealous for His own glory and for His own holiness. And yet so often we act irreverently. We come with all of our sin and we don't confess it and cover it, as it were, under the atoning blood of Christ, and we march on in the Christian life and we wonder why God isn't blessing. May God help us not to be foolish and not to treat that which is holy as profane. May He help us this week to live in a way that truly produces the glory of God in our lives, and that's a holy lifestyle.